Sunday night, then that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Bring Bill back up for a moment, please. Thank you. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 149th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 148 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's John Mack 13. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com, and Westchester Guardian is Westchestergardian. It includes the 205th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the column, and if the spirit moves you, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Also at my web home, you'll find links, in addition to the previous radio shows, to my online daily newspaper. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts and entertainment, opinion, and technology. But the real focus on artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, to what lies ahead. Try it and subscribe. It's free and is only one email per day. And once again, that's at www.johnmack13.com. So I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live or as most do, listen later. Notifications of the most recent shows are sent out weekly by email and on Facebook. Next week's show will feature Inward Eyed and the next 60 Minutes producer, Dennis Blakely. Then out to this show, callers may call him at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of the interview with my guests. My guest tonight is Virginia Heffernan, Harvard PhD in English, editor, writer, columnist, and author of the recently published Magic and Lost, The Internet is Art. I first met Virginia a number of years ago, if met is the proper word, online after I read some of her New York Times Sunday Magazine articles. Right from the beginning, I've invited Virginia to be on the show, but at that time, to family obligation, Sunday evenings didn't work for her. Now it's the publication of her new book, two great reviews from New York Times, Slate, and others. Her schedule has loosened a bit, and here she is. Before introducing Virginia, a word on the book. I highly recommend it, but warn the audience that no matter how hard we try, we will not do justice to the work tonight. It's deep and dense without being difficult. An easy read, but requires thought and pondering. So, in our discussion of the magic and loss, if we spend time on Virginia's background, which is really fleshed out in the book, by the way, if we hold your interest, and I expect we will, then buy the book. It's available in hardcover and on Kindle. After that rather long-winded introduction, let's get started with tonight's John Mack Radio Show and Virginia Heffernan. Good evening and welcome to the show, Virginia.
Hi, John. I'm glad we could do it on a Sunday night. I'm looking forward to talking.
Virginia, I mentioned hardcover and Kindle. Is it also available on Nook and in EPUB format?
Absolutely. And it's also, there's an audiobook that Candace Thaxton reads that I've heard a little bit of, and I hear it's great. Her delivery is amazing. And I only read the preface, so you only have to listen to me trying to hide my lisp for about 15 pages.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up, then go to early school?
So I was born in Hanover, New Hampshire, and spent my whole childhood there until I left for college. Hanover is the home of Dartmouth College, and an academic town focused on liberal arts. My father taught English in the English department, but my childhood underwent a sea change, or my education underwent a sea change, the way a lot of people's do now when I first encountered computers in the late 70s. So I was lucky or unlucky enough to have Dartmouth College got a new president. That president, John Kemeny, had co-written the computer language BASIC in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s. And he came to be president of Dartmouth College. Dartmouth was then known as a football school. The town was, it seemed like it had been co-ed only very recently. And it was a pretty bro school, though we didn't call it that. And he brought this Hungarian genius and innovation to the campus that had been fairly old-fashioned. The first thing he wanted to do was install this mainframe computer in the middle of town. I think that in order to give up the real estate, or for some other reason, the town negotiated that if he was going to do that, he was going to have to spread the word of computer programming to the local school children. The Hanover Improvement Society, very New England idea that we were supposed to, various things were supposed to bring us to greater rectitude and knowledge. The Hanover Improvement Society hosted Kemeny to speak to the school children, and I was among them. I was 9, and I sat through a lecture on BASIC that taught us to write a simple program. Now, the other people that were captivated by the talk, you can imagine lots of the kids were not captivated by the talk and left, but 5 of us were, and of those, 4 went on to really learn BASIC and learn some other computer languages, but I got sidelined in a way that I first thought was trivial and then came to realize was immensely rewarding, which is I just started hanging around the Kiewit Computing Center with some of my friends and ultimately learned to join one of the first network computing systems in the ARPANET era, which was it was a time-sharing system where people dialed into this heaving rhinoceros of a mainframe computer with their modems. And I joined a group called Conference XYZ. And Conference XYZ had all the hallmarks you see of Facebook now, except very, very minimal. That black background, the phosphor green letters in the front. And I made up a name for myself, Athena. And like a lot of us, have been living a life both offline with my real name and then online with various avatars, kind of creating this character online. And that started very early. I never saw it as, I never saw it as this is real life. I never got confused that the computer was eating me up or that I was entering the matrix. And I don't get confused now. And I think a lot of us don't get confused now. But in the reporting about the internet, we see all this concern that we're getting lost or that we're living our lives getting bullied. And so in part, I wanted to write the book to empower people to embrace that, creative side that wants to play Athena online, that wants to make photographs for Instagram or create collages for Pinterest. And do all the things that the internet has freed us to do.
You're way ahead of me. I'm still in grammar school. It's interesting. Kemeny then Kurtz, originally wrote BASIC as the teaching language. It was never expected to be a commercial language. And it was because the only language that we used for teaching at that time was Fortran. It was the mathematical language. And it was only because Paul Allen convinced Bill Gates that they could jam the BASIC interpreter into the first consumer micro, the Altair, that BASIC became the de facto language of the early personal computers. So it really took off.
That is. Those are great details. I mean, yes, Fortran and Pascal were seen as, at least, you know, to us as kids, as the real languages. You know, very difficult. They were. You'd be really talking to the machine if you knew those languages. They were, you know, much closer to mathematics, where BASIC was, you know, consummately user friendly.
And it was an interpreted language that with micros. You could write an instruction, you could execute it, and you could see what happened.
There was something magic about seeing that first BASIC program work. It made me want more, you know.
What about high school? Where'd you go to high school?
So I stayed in town and went to the local high school, and I will say that began my disillusionment with computers. So I had spent my late childhood and early adolescence really loving the possibilities of this network computing. It was part game, part social life. But when I got to high school, that was really, and you know, in some ways it's hard to remember since it's the titans of our world who are associated with computers and the internet now, but I'm sure you remember well, it wasn't the fast track to popularity, especially for a girl, to have your head down at a computer all the time. So it was the first time, right? So it was the first time someone started singing the song Desperado whenever I came around because they knew I was on computers or used the internet before the internet was called that. And that, you know, sent a shudder down my spine. I felt, you know, shamed, and I decided that I would never touch a computer again. I resolved I'd never touch a computer again. You know, in some ways that was good. I devoted myself much more to the humanities, I mean, as much as you can in high school. So I started doing languages, not Fortran and Pascal, but French and German and Latin and then English, and sort of set myself up for a life in the humanities, much more in culture than in computers.
As an aside, I believe you were the classmate there of the president candidate for Congress in New York State. Is that not so?
Oh, Zephyr Teachout. Yes, she was actually a year behind me, but yes, she went to Hanover High School. I will also, as a shout out to Hanover High School, say Robbie Mook, who's Hillary Clinton's campaign director. Is there the Matt Dunn, who's running for governor in Vermont, went to Hanover High School. I think it was, we had the first primary in New Hampshire, and so kids got really excited about that every year and thought that every 4 years and thought that politics might be for them.
Did you also aspire to be a writer while in high school?
I definitely did. So I liked. I was drawn to, it's kind of hard to put it this way, but I was drawn to sort of not especially expressive or not especially, or not, and not fiction, expressive writing and not fiction. What I liked was very formal writing. So like, you know, proving your point in an essay and very tightly formal poetry. So it's like almost that OCD kind where you're counting syllables all the time and, you know, trying to fit letters into a square. And, you know, in that way, I didn't want to write cathartic, memoir-y kind of writing. And in that way, I think that my interest in being a writer synced a little bit with my interest in computing. You know, I loved it when I first saw Twitter, 140 characters, and you were supposed to use all this new typography, the at signs and the hashtags. I felt like I'd come home, you know, this like incredibly challenging formal requirements on language is what excites me. You know, when I'm told like you have this whole book, just fill it with every thought and it's ever come into your head, every feeling you've ever had, I'm completely blocked. But if someone says, you know, try to write three sentences that have no E's in them and tell the story of a person locked in an elevator. I rise to it.
then you're okay. Did you write for the school paper or for the publication while you were in high school?
I wrote a good thing about growing up in a small town, you know, maybe you know and people, some of your listeners know, is you can access the local press fairly easily. So My parents are both writers. They encouraged me when we went on trips to send letters home to the local newspaper, the Valley News. And so I had a taste of publication then. I did do some work on the yearbook, the literary journal, but I wasn't a totally devoted high school student. I was more likely to get carried away working on one paper or reading one book and let the rest slide. I to beef up my transcript, volunteered at Special Olympics as a coach, basketball coach. And I found it really interesting, partly because I found it utterly corrupt, that there were all these things I thought going on wrong with the money and the way things were allocated and the way members were accepted and teams were chosen. I don't want to go too far afield, but just to say that I then decided that I should write an expose of Special Olympics for my college essays, and I was soundly rejected by the schools for whom I wrote that essay. I think, what someone later told me is Special Olympics is like a sacred cow. And as a high school student, you're not supposed to be, tearing things up like that. So anyway, I still believe there are problems in the administration there, but fortunately it's not my business to expose them.
That wouldn't have gone over with Ethel Kennedy either.
That's exactly what they said. They were like, this is a Kennedy project. You got to keep this to yourself when you're 17 years old.
You mentioned the conferencing system, but then you mentioned that you got away from computers. A bit later than the conference system, I became involved in something called MOOS, multi-user object-oriented text-based realities. That came out of Xerox PARC originally, and was amazed the impact that it had on many people, including myself. Did you get involved with any MOOS or anything?
I did not, and I think it's because, although interestingly they keep coming up recently, I think that it's possible that I was in my phase of I cannot never touch a computer again, or that it just didn't come through the Dartmouth time sharing system in the same way. The conference XYZ was a subset of something they called Excalibur, just X and then Calibur. And it sort of was a chat room for people to talk, to troubleshoot problems in the time sharing system. But then it also, like a lot of things, turned quickly into chat. But at the same time, it had all these game elements. One of the things, and maybe you can correct me on this if it's not true to your experience, but one of the things I've sort of noticed is that, well, let me say this. Years ago, I read an article in The Atlantic saying there's never been the bones of humans found, primitive humans found, without the bones of a dog found nearby. In other words, dogs and humans just go together. Like they just are like practically one organism. And, in spite of the fact that we imagine that engineers work in this left brain world devising systems all the time, as far as I can tell, even from the time when computer programmers were largely employed in Silicon Valley to write manuals, to write how-to manuals, there was always a culture around it. There was always using names and handles like people had done with ham radio and CB radio. There was always social life, obviously. There were always little jokes and Easter eggs put into the code. And then there were always these funny things like language that you could create. I'm sure that, you probably remember when people would scroll each other, not troll each other, scroll each other. In other words, like greet them with a bunch of ampersands that were just mischief to make their screen go up really fast or their printer and lose a lot of space. Sometimes you could make a little face with the ampersands. I mean, this all sounds very, very silly, but this is like how cultures are born. And
I would even give you the plug, because in 1984, there was a book published well ahead of its time. We probably sold about 25 copies, maybe 100. And then Esther Dyson who was part of our group, gave one to each of her subscribers, a couple of hundred. But there's a book called Digital Deli that a bunch of us that were computer writers in the at that time then used to meet for lunch put an anthology together. And not only did we reach outside of our group to Bill Gates and to Mitch Kapoor and to Dan Brooklyn and to, and to Robert Moog, but we also had contributions to it from William F. Buckley Jr., from Henny Youngman, from John D. McDonald, the mystery writer, from Ray Bradbury. And
did
it was,
you say Henny Youngman?
Henny Youngman, yes.
Wow. This is amazing.
He was one of the interesting people at the at our book party, which was at the New York Deli. And he stood around and he told jokes. The entire book, with the exception of two articles that they didn't get the copyright for, are on the internet. All the articles there. They're at the Atari Archives website. But if you do the search on Digital Deli, you get all the articles. It was way ahead of its time, but they were already building this of who uses computers and why they use it, and Herbie Hancock had something about music.
Yep.
I'm sure you'll appreciate. So all of these things, all they came together. What did you do after high school?
So I went to college. I went to the University of Virginia, where my father had taught and my mother had gone to graduate school. And I, on some level, instantly realized I'd made a mistake. The town I grew up in was, the sort of milieu of Hanover that I grew up in was extremely liberal. I thought I wanted to get away from that, but I think I overcorrected by going to a Southern school where, among other things, they had a gay pride day. I don't know what they called it, but it was basically a day where you sort of showed your affiliation for your support for other gay students. And in order to do that, you were expected to wear jeans. And this was in the fall of my first year. Well, I went out of my dorm and the campus was a sea of Madras. Everyone was in Madras pants and skirts. And, I don't know. You don't grow up with parents whose friends are like in the German department and the art department without growing up with a lot of gay people. And I was instantly astounded. I will say that 4 years in what was then a very conservative campus driven by Greek life, it taught me an enormous amount. And if I'd been interested with the internet early on in meeting different populations of people, and I was, I got to meet a lot there. The other thing that happened is the social life, except for a wonderful group of people that I stayed friends with, the social life both wasn't interested in me and I wasn't interested in it, which is a very good setup to make a good student of you, finally. I told you I didn't work especially hard in high school, but in college I didn't have much else to do. So I found my way to an English double major, English and philosophy. The philosophy department was entirely made up of Oxford and Cambridge analytic philosophers. So they were doing stuff that we would consider quite arcane now about why does a penny look like an ellipse from a certain angle? And it was very not for someone looking for answers on the big questions. But fortunately, the department was sort of hijacked by Richard Rorty, who'd come from Princeton. He's a pragmatist. He refused to call himself a philosopher by then because he'd gotten so interested in the way language works that he thought philosophy was better served by literary criticism. In any case, he started a department called the Department of the Humanities. He was the only member of it. And I was instantly really blown away by a philosophy that drew from a lot of European philosophy, but was fundamentally American and also fundamentally, I'm trying to optimistic and hopeful and asked very simply that you make your private life beautiful and you make your public life humane. And that as marching lessons for living really served me. You know, how much is your digital life? And I will say there that I got a taste back of computers toward the very end. I used them to do formal logic programs in my philosophy major, formal logic problems. So, like if PVNQ, modus ponens, modus tollens, trying to, you know, just logical proofs. And they were perfect on a computer. I mean, you could do those things on graph paper for hours and hours and hours and only get three or four of them done. But when you can get a computer to troubleshoot it, my learning curve was so fast. You know, I realized like 8 hours, 9 hours in the, you know, in front of this computer, and I was making enormous progress, you know, on something. I mean, it's just like, you know, obviously that's why the first use for computers are the most sensible, you know, clear use. I don't think anyone in mathematics thinks that we should go back to a time before computers, unlike in literature. You know, there's no love lost between, you know, just doing everything on graph paper, although there's a place for that. But in any case, I was completely enchanted and drawn back into computers that way. And then I knew that AOL, toward the end of my time in college, that AOL and CompuServe were incipient and were appearing places, and people had intra-email addresses. We didn't have email addresses by the time I graduated in 91 at UVA, but my father had gotten one at Dartmouth, the Blitzmail address. And I was starting to remember that I wanted to be able to bring that Rorty philosophy, make your private life beautiful and make your public life humane. And I wanted to bring that to this world that was fast developing, this networked world. And, you know, in some ways, Magic and Loss, the book, is an effort to do that, you know, it's a lifelong effort to do that. And I have made many mistakes. My private avatar is certainly not always beautiful, and her productions on Instagram and Twitter and whatever can be faulted for all kinds of things. And then, you know, as far as my public life, there are lapses from it being humane or civil plenty of times. But as my marching orders, those are what they are. So taking the principles from philosophy and the humanities into digital life, you know, has been, I don't want to sound grandiose, but that's like my prime directive. That's my Starship Enterprise prime directive.
some asides there. The reason that microcomputers took off, it wasn't because of the hobbyists, it wasn't because of the basic programming. It was because that the first spreadsheet ever conceived, PhysiCalc, was developed on an Apple II by Dan Bricklin, who you probably know his story. He was a graduate student in the Harvard Business School, and they had to do these internal spreadsheets about what would happen if this changed. Mm-hmm. And he came up with the idea, and from then on, they took off.
Yeah, I mean, it's for any symbolic. I'm glad you brought up spreadsheets, but let's come back to them. Yes, you were saying.
I was a philosophy major for a year, and then I saw there weren't many jobs in the New York Times, so I switched to something much more practical, English literature, and then by the grace of God, I just wound up in the technology field, and then I was off.
Well, you know, that's my path too. I really did want to do philosophy. Then as you say, I then went for the much more lucrative, promising degree, and I did a double major, but then I after college went to graduate school in English. But that was such the early days of the web, and I couldn't repress my love of computers anymore. So I got a bad digital habit again, and that's what enabled me to be able to write, as it was becoming a subject in journalism to write about, to help with all the wonderful writers around, help crystallize what digital criticism, what tech criticism might be like.
Mine was even more basic than that. That I've written the book of poetry and two other books and 2,000 columns and articles, and I can't type. If it wasn't for computers with spell checkers and do it over, I never would have been a writer. In discussing and Richard Rorty is one of the great names in American philosophy. Anyhow,
that's right. Yeah.
In discussing your studies, at UVA, you mentioned that you, an Episcopalian in childhood, were drawn to the Jewish philosophers, particularly Ludwig Wittgenstein. Tell us something about him and his attraction for you.
I like how you know, you really get into it. As I mentioned, we were studying analytic philosophy, so A.J. Ayer and to some extent Bertrand Russell, but other philosophers who always have two initials and then a last name. They're just like British philosophers who, most of whom have been forgotten from the 20th century. But anyway, they imagined that language proceeded in a very, very logical way, and that they concerned themselves with making sentences, creating belief statements that were, quote, falsifiable, so they could be proved wrong. And without that you were speaking nonsense. The idea was you were speaking nonsense. And Wittgenstein was like a half step for me towards something, you know, more far out, more post-structuralist, more like deconstruction, which I hate to say my name because it's still like a punchline and to so many people. But so Wittgenstein considered that language did not actually correspond to the exact perfect world, and I mean have a perfect correspondence to the world, but that, and you, I am being very schematic here, but that it was a series of overlapping games. And as someone who had come to the internet to play games, adventure games, role-playing games, and someone who loves games of every kind, I thought the idea of language, one of my first loves, and games, the other of my first loves, language games just seemed wonderful to me. And, you know, anyone, I think there's a book called The Blue and Brown Books, very short, that is a wonderful set of essays that Wittgenstein wrote that outlines his approach to language. He says language, the words don't point to things in the real world. They have a life of their own. And so, you know, in some ways, Wittgenstein was part of the path out of worrying about getting language to conform to mathematics, or getting language to conform to science, or getting language to conform to logic, which had been the, you know, futile task of my first couple of years studying philosophy. And from there, I went to Richard Rorty. But yes, I mean, as you can see, I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing that I fell for Wittgenstein so hard and then Rorty, but but it definitely was a result of my feeling alienated socially at the school, because I probably never would have, you know, it's probably lucky for something that I didn't, wasn't invited to any parties, because I could spend all my night in the logic lab or whatever.
another side, I saw Tim Kaine on last night talking about his background, and a Republican governor of Virginia he completely broke with the tide in the state and the legislature by integrating the schools when the Southern schools were against integration, obviously, and he sent his own children to public schools. His daughter then went to Harvard, and she met Tim Kaine, and she married him. So when Tim Kaine became governor of Virginia and moved into the mansion, his daughter was the first woman that had ever been the child in the mansion and the first lady in the mansion. I thought that was interesting.
Wow. Wonderful. Yeah, he seems really extraordinary. You know, and you touched on, obviously, a very, very religious person. You touched on religion for me, and that does be, you know, not to step on the book's ending, but that does come into the ending of the book. That's
where I'm going right now.
Got it. Okay.
To digress a bit from your biographical timeline, you take us through your own religious path, from Christianity through a flirtation with atheism, interest in Islam, movement to Judaism, and then a return to Christianity. What was the impetus to these moves, and are you still in search mode where religion is concerned?
No, I think I've settled. It's been about 5 years, pretty comfortably settled. That's right. I think I had, as soon as I heard that polyglot world of networked computing, I knew there were so many, you know, there are more things in heaven and earth, that I can, than I could dream of. And I, you know, I just became interested in hearing and seeing them all. And that includes the major world religions. So I was, my father's Catholic, my mother's Episcopalian. They gave us the option of where to be baptized at 7, and my brother and I chose the Episcopal Church because we'd mostly been there. We had a big dose of Catholicism too. In any case, I left that behind. I became a defiant atheist, refused to say grace and stuff when I came home. And then I really wanted a robust intellectual life, and the, you know, tradition of Anglican inquiry. A lot of the Christian inquiry had turned anti-intellectual, and it was also true that a lot of my teachers in high school and my professors in college that most interested me were Jewish, and many of them European. So, you know, if it's the 90s, there's still enough of them that had come after the war, and so they. I just got very interested in the Jewish tradition of inquiry, and that influenced me all the way up till my conversion to Judaism in 2003. I married a man who'd grown up Orthodox, and our children were born Jewish, and they still are in Jewish day school. When my husband and I got divorced, I had already felt a pull back to my church. But I had also been, increasingly hooked up with that kind of techno-spirituality. Who knows how to describe it? You know, it's funny that it inspires a certain nervousness and abashedness to talk about religion on the East Coast, you know, in New York City. When the second you set foot in San Francisco, everyone's either listening to Deepak Chopra, trying to hack death so they can live forever, doing some, 12-step program. The tech world seemed much more hospitable to competing beliefs. And, you know, I think in some ways that's a function of the Internet itself. You know, I fell in love with that phosphor screen, the phosphor letters on the front, that deep, dark space in the background, the pre-bitmap, pre-pixmap, pre-Apple interface, which is very suggestive, filled with mystery and pathos and a sense that you're looking into something much, much bigger than you are. And whether that was just an effect of that particular terminal or whether, you know, that was actually a view on something, I sort of stopped asking myself that because that mystery was so fascinating to me. And so when I returned to the Episcopal Church, it was with a heavy dose of awe, you know, and wonder. Engendered by the internet, but also inspired by the night sky and by nature itself.
The mutual friend of ours who's had some impact in an internet culture was a major at that Wesleyan, John Perry Barlow.
Yes, that's right. So John Perry Barlow, who'd been a lyricist for the Grateful Dead, and a great believer, the originated the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a great believer in the liberation of information. Marshall McLuhan was a Catholic mystic. The great, great Kevin Kelly, one of the co-founders of Wired, is also a Christian, also, very committed to his faith, and it suffuses all his books. So I don't think there's a surprise that people interested in technology are also, you know, science and technology are very different, and they're very different practices, and they have very different spiritual consequences, you know, and they put you culturally in a different position, investment in one or investment in the other, which is not to say that plenty of scientists don't also experience that sense of awe and wonder. The book, as you may know, ends with an exchange I had with Frank Wilczek, who won the Nobel Prize in physics in the early part of this century, and anyway, that I don't want to spoil, but it was very, it was extraordinary for me anyway, as a sort of window in to what might connect, what might connect the sciences, what might connect, you know, pure mathematics with digital culture, digital religion, the humanities, literature, the arts, online.
I had Kevin Kelly on the show about a month ago. His new book's very interesting, and he was
a terrific book. Yes, he's a hero of mine.
Did you write for publications, school or otherwise, while in college?
Yes, I did. That's when I really started writing. My friend Mike Albo and I, who I went on to write a different book with, we were edited the literary magazine, the Virginia Literary Review, and I also wrote regularly for the Alt Weekly, or the weekly called The Declaration, and because these were the days, that was a great thing about UVA. Very strong press, very strong student body, there were two daily newspapers for the campus. Daily, every day, Saturday and Sunday, also the Cavalier Daily and the University Journal. And the Cavalier Daily is still in business and does great reporting. So those were two things I can thank UVA for, absolutely. And I wrote a lot for them. You know, I wrote a lot of movie reviews, did a little news reporting, and a lot of essays. I like the form of the essay, you know. And I think a lot of people do too. If you hang out on Facebook and you see a long post, often what you're reading is an essay.
Yep. And then it was off to Harvard for a master's and then a PhD in English literature. Tell us about the Harvard years.
The Harvard years. Well, I don't want to sound like I don't like any of the places I went to college, to school, but, you know, and those are in some ways like those are very turbulent years for anyone. Harvard was like terrifying, essentially. Like, first off, they had done, they told me that they had done some admissions plan to attract students from the hinterlands that weren't all polished and up to snuff on the most important writers. So, like, they hadn't read Walter Benjamin and the Frankfurt School. And as I said, I had been reading these analytic philosophers and ultimately a little bit of deconstruction, but that wasn't what they, you know, wanted. But anyway, so they thought I was, like, a wonderful provincial kid from the University of Virginia that they would sort of let in out of noblesse oblige or something. I'm exaggerating, but there were a group of us who hadn't been to the Ivy League as undergraduates who were supposed to count ourselves very lucky that we were there. And I did. You know, I really, really did. And I worked with Philip Fisher, with Elaine Scarry, and then my advisor was Mark Schell. Henry Louis Gates Jr. was also briefly my advisor. And that was, I mean, it's just a mind-blowing opportunity. I mean, part of the fear I felt was just, you know, standing on the edge of these extraordinary ideas and, you know, just pushing yourself to read every novel of Thomas Hardy, you know, or really read Milton is, that's a lot to ask of, like, one little mind, you know, to try to wrestle with Milton or Spencer or Chaucer or Shakespeare. And, you know, we had to do that. It's a very traditional program. And, you know, I went for 2 years, but after 2 years, it was kind of, I started writing for the Boston Phoenix, and it kind of had become, you know, almost as much as I could emotionally handle to take on all this reading and all these brilliant people, and then the pressure of being at a very visible school like Harvard. And so I moved to New York and had a wonderful year sort of off from all that. When I really hit my stride working at The New Yorker, I lucked into that iconic job as a fact checker at The New Yorker and was happier than I've ever been. And in some ways, I've never looked back. I loved that life. There was all the intelligence that I loved at Harvard and a little bit less madness. So that I loved that. And I made great friends there and had a lot of fun. But I couldn't leave the dissertation undone. Moved back to Cambridge, finished it, did the teaching part. I like teaching. But that time I was determined to stay in journalism. So I kept writing for the now defunct Boston Phoenix, the Alt Weekly in Boston. And writing again about culture and, you know, young women writers are often pushed to do memoirs, so there's a little bit of that. But as much as possible, I tried to do book reviews and movie reviews. And then by the time I finished the dissertation, I was already moving toward journalism. And then I moved back to New York and worked at a series of really terrific magazines and ended at the Times, and then left the Times, worked at the Times for 11 years, left that for Yahoo News, and had I loved the Times. I was sure that Yahoo would be a continuation of the Times, but it wasn't. I was working with lots of people I'd worked with at the Times, but it wasn't the same thing. And since then, I've been more or less freelance, consulting for, working on, you know, doing the book, publishing the book, and consulting for startups and VC firms, and also writing for a ton of magazines, which is just too hard to give up.
I saw some of the publications that you've written for, in addition to Wired, the Wall Street Journal, and Mother Jones. That's some combination.
Yeah, that's right. And I covered the convention this past week for the Times, so I still go back to the Times and did a bunch of op-ed columns for the LA Times this summer. So yeah, I like that. I like writing for, I like being able to also write for Medium and for other platforms that are, you know, that are just my own. You know, it's amazing because once the digital culture became my home, it became possible. And I'm sure you've had this experience too. You know, when you write about the internet, you can write about anything, you know, so, you know, it comes time for an election, and this happened to me at Yahoo. I wrote about the digital election, especially the Romney campaign, and, you know, they had a bunch of kids running digital for them, which meant, you know, at what point do you get Mitt Romney on Instagram? At what point do you get his wife on Pinterest? And it was fascinating to see the election play out in social media, on message boards, and so on. I just spent some of last week watching the Republican National Convention on Twitch, the board for gamers, the huge giant platform for video gamers. They run the convention coverage and then have like a scroll right next to it where people comment on it. And hearing gamers, the way gamers see, you know, a speech by Melania Trump or a speech by Newt Gingrich is really, really eye-opening.
To mention gamers before, I'm sure that you're probably familiar with the book by Jay McGonigal, where she where she and her TED talk and the book talk about gamers being the saviors of the world if we can channel them in the right direction.
Yeah, she's amazing that way, I love that book. Absolutely. I mean, I'll say one thing. For Twitch users, it's not a surprise that the language is so aggressive and emotional and polarized and id-driven in this particular election. It's like, it's one thing to hear the usual talking heads and analysts try to make sense of the difference between the parties right now or the particular kind of virulent energy in the Republican Party. It's another, but they're trying to fit it into a template and a norm, and where does this come from? If you read about it on Twitch, what you see are these quick takes that really represent, it's extremely emotional and impressionistic. You know, and very educational. If nothing else, you learn this amazing new set of terms and dialect that I didn't know existed. I had to look up almost everything I saw in there.
Now, related to that, and back to the book, you point out earlier that our internet culture is something different, and its various functions should not be looked at as analogous to previous activities. There's been nothing really comparable to Instagram, Spotify, Wikipedia, even email before. Yet writers for years have looked for precursors to today's technologies to explain them. Why are they wrong?
Well, the technologies. Okay, there's a couple of things. I do want to argue that all those services are on a continuum with their precedents, but I think that those precedents go back much further. So Instagram is closer to and makes sense understood as in the tradition of frescoes, of any two-dimensional imagery, images, and efforts to represent the world more and more with more and more realism. At the same time, Instagram falls into exactly what art history often does, which is to shift the balance of power from the object, which in a realist, you know, in a realist worldview, the object is king. So, you know, early photography or hyper-realist photography tries to be faithful to the world as it is, to very impressionistic photography where, like, heavily filtered and doctored selfies are much more true to the vision of the, you know, of the subject, of the person taking them. So in that way, Instagram does fit into this tradition. But if it's seen merely as, you know, the way the iPhone camera responds or is different from a Canon, or and then the Canon was different from a Leica or a, you know, Polaroid, or then I think you miss that larger picture. So that's one thing. And also the efforts to analogize, and we're sticking to photography, but the same can be said, and you know, the book is divided into chapters that reflect all these art forms or art endeavors that have existed since ancient times, including text, which is the name I give now to poetry. That includes Twitter, the language on Facebook, the language on message boards. As we said, photography or images, film, which, you know, film obviously didn't exist in ancient times, but performance and dance did, and that's where we see it on YouTube now. And finally, music. So anyway, I take each of those forms. I do see a larger story, a larger historical story of this move toward digitization in all these forms and in the culture at large. But I don't, you know, Instagram is no longer the same thing that photography was, that darkroom photography was. It's just like the analogy is too hard. I see why we use those little metaphors, why the old Instagram app, you know, was a camera, was the front of a camera. But it doesn't, but that is, you know, that's an effort to ease us into a world where, you know, Instagram technology is much less about faithful representation of the world as it is about the velocity with which these little, this little visual vocabulary is exchanged and expanded.
You also quite openly disagree with the Nicholas Carrs of the world, who point out nothing but negative impacts of the internet world on those of us who immerse ourselves in it. Would you like to expand on your criticism of the gloom writers a bit?
Yeah. So yeah, Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, that you know, the internet's making us dumber and possibly making us less humane or less compassionate, or and certainly, yeah, the internet has been, just as television before it, blamed for virtually everything, making us fatter, making us crueler. I think one of the larger points of the book that I don't think I make as explicitly as I maybe want to is that move to abstraction away from material things is ultimately a good thing. And we're lucky because no amount of abstraction can abolish the material world. And so the material world often pushes back on efforts to abstract from it. But let me give you just two examples. So, you know, and they're quite schematic because they're ancient world descriptions, but when money went from barter then to gold, a third party or a third object idea to mediate, that gold has to be mined. It's brutal, it's dangerous, it's dirty, but that's where it is. Then gold is pressed into ingots. They're no longer worth necessarily their weight. The inscription on them becomes very important, the Caesar inscription, the writing. Then to paper, then to, you know, electronic pulses, maybe now to Bitcoin. Those are moves away from they first of all liberate money so that more people can have money. You know, it's always people who want the gold standard are usually people who want to keep the money to themselves. You know, Bitcoin makes money still more accessible. Then take, you know, in the church, or in Judaism or in the early church, you have animal sacrifice that then gives way to prayer. You know, you have the drawing of blood, and then in the world at large, you have a warlike time that gives way to commerce. So does it mean that commerce is always, you probably know this Alberto Hirschman book, Arguments for Capitalism Before Its Triumph, The Passions and the Interests, such a good book about, this, that commerce has this sweetening effect on, on this Hobbesian world, where we finally have to try to understand what someone else might want, what they might need in order to sell it to them, in order to exchange with them. And so the internet does this too. Let's take a hot button example, online bullying. So I reviewed this book recently, Nancy Jo Sales' book, American Girls. It's a great book about girls using the internet. And one of the things it says is that they get harassed, and some of it is sexual harassment. What sexual harassment looks like are nude pictures. People traffic in nude pictures of them, of each other. And often they're grafting with the head of one of them onto a nude body of somebody else and then distributing it and trying to wreck their reputations. This is incredibly painful and difficult, and people need to set up greater ways to, form immunity to it and sidestep it and educate themselves about it. At the same time, when I was in high school, and probably when you were too, the dangers to girls and boys alike were sexually transmitted diseases, rape, and early pregnancy. Those are physical problems. Those are problems that kill you. The exchange of Instagram pictures that you don't like is horrible. I've been bullied online many times. It's terrible. It's hurtful and painful. But it is nothing like the thing that it ends up replacing. And that, that's a hard thing in a way to say out loud, because I don't want to minimize the pain done by, digital aggression. But, having been on the receiving end of it and having been called every name in the book on Twitter, I can still tell you that having been called every name in the book on Twitter, and yes, they were misogynistic, and yes, they were vulgar, I would rather have that happen to me than than spend 1 second getting beat up physically. So that move to greater and greater symbolism, it does always make us feel like we're losing things to a more and more symbolic, more and more abstract order. And I get why it's painful to people. And in some ways, the loss in the book is that I also feel like I've lost things from analog times that were important to me. And I'm very impressed to see the culture pushing back on it and reviving vinyl, reviving live music, putting a premium on in-person experiences or in physical space experiences, Buddhism, and so on. But I also think that the move to greater abstraction is always a good thing. And it's always the way civilization improves itself, finds more elegance, finds more organization, and ideally becomes more humane.
Well, I went to an all-male Catholic high school in the pre-pill days, so I wasn't in danger of being sexually harassed, but that didn't happen then. But I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think you're right on. While we're on the subject the writers you disagree with, you have nothing good to say about one of the icons of the technology world, Ray Kurzweil. He spent a good deal of time explaining the progression of computer power in the 20th century. Do you find anything in his work of merit?
Well, I don't think I say much about the singularity except to say that he's solidly in the camp of the mystics. I mean, he's pretty way out there now. I think he now thinks that life is a simulation in the mind of a computer. There's a master programmer. And I certainly don't know enough to tell him that he's wrong. That seems unfalsifiable to me. But in any case, so what I like about him is a willingness to make big claims. One thing I sort of thought was when I wrote this book, I thought, there's something so wonderfully playful and that's allowed in essays, as almost nowhere else about these kind of grandiose provocations that you don't, for example, the book claims that the internet is the great masterpiece of civilization. I mean, what would it be to prove that, right or wrong, right? On the other hand, I hope that it serves as an invitation for readers to reflect on their own experience with the internet, because it's such a powerful and all-pervasive experience, and yet, sometimes we react more with fear than with rigor, And I was hoping, and I, what I've noticed is people like you have shared with me their early experience of the internet, and also have been spending a lot of time reflecting on what it might mean to them, or you know, where the magic and the loss lies. Ray Kurzweil, so you know, 90% of me thinks that he's been an extraordinary contributor to this, much, much better than the fearful, you know, those filled with fear who've either been Luddites or told us that we all have to, you know, restrict our internet use to only 20 minutes a day, or, you know, the worst thing in the world, been apocalyptic at every stage. This is going to ruin Hollywood. It's going to ruin the dinner table. It's going to ruin our waistlines. It's going to ruin, you know. So anyway, those 90% of me is pro Kurzweil. The 10% that's reserved is that he is this, you know, in his latest incarnation as selling supplements, you know, health supplements that are supposed to help you live forever. Everyone I know who's seen him recently says he doesn't do anything but take these supplements. You have to take so many of them a day. You know, I guess he's putting his money where his mouth is. You know, he's made huge claims for, you know, that mortality is just a bug in the human code that can be circumnavigated. And, you know, I now know a lot of body hackers and quantified self types. And it's a full-time job. It's a full-time job. So the thing is, I'll be saying that about him today, and maybe someone will one day find the recording. And in 100 years, he'll be the one laughing and still alive.
John Norton and his From Gutenberg to Zuckerberg spends a good deal of time in describing how the technology has physically changed us in a way that no one has seen since the advent of the printing press. He quotes Marianne Wolf from Prost and the Squid, the story and science of the reading brain, showing how our brains have physically changed. His writing seems to me to tie in with your writing, as he sees us adapting to the new culture that you've described without us even realizing it. Do you see a connection?
It's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I haven't read that, and I want to. I do, you know, I sort of think... I've been trying to find, I think someone recently asked me if I thought that there ought to be a digital party or an internet party. And I suddenly realized that it's way too late for that. That would be like having a market capitalism party. It's the air we breathe, the internet, you know, that would be like having a party, I don't know, about oxygen, you know, devoted to oxygen. You can't be against it. You certainly can't be against it. I mean, the ways that we, you know, the number of cell phone subscriptions on Earth rivals the number of people on Earth. You know, we are all participating in cellular and wireless technology, Ethernet technology, and living in some ways through the tubes. Often, incidentally, you know, the digital divide always has it that a certain number of elites will control it. But as far as just users go, you know, Bruce Sterling, the thinker, says it's the poor who love their cell phones the most. You know, the ones who live and die by connectivity are people who don't actually have a huge house filled with perfect Moroccan-bound books in their library and, you know, food every night and can blissfully take, you know, a tech Sabbath once a week. Most of us need a level of constant connection because we need to make our living that way, because we don't actually have a house with a wine cellar, because that's how you can, you know, that's how you can read a book, pay your bills with a thumb, you know? That's I think changed the way we live. I think it's not a surprise whatever comes of this election. I don't think it's a surprise that we're in a populist time, in part because we're finally so aware of the huge number, what a polyglot world we're living in. Now, you know, the Republicans right now have cast that populist figure as this, you know, one monolith voice that doesn't actually exist in very many corners of the internet. But I do think that sudden awareness, and when I was looking back into that dark depth on that first computer in 79, Zenith Z19 terminal, I think I was looking at everyone who was out there. You know, all the people that at that time were dialing in, and just coming to terms with the fact that when you are signing into Facebook, you're signing into a place where hundreds of billions of people are signing in monthly. My mind is too small to really register that without just calling it a mystery.
Bruce Sterling is one of the funniest people in the world.
God,
one of,
is he
one
ever.
Of the great speakers.
Yeah,
and
I love
19, it. And his 1986 science fiction novel, Islands in the Net, so far ahead of everything. He was talking about data pirates. He was talking about goggles that you wore to communicate, glasses. It was just a terrific book.
I've got to look at that too. That speech he gave where he said connectivity is poverty was at South by Southwest several years ago. And I just, that was where I sort of got the idea that it would be fun as, you know, I'm a mother of two. I live, you know, pretty, I'm just, whatever. I'm not like some overman, Ray Kurzweil, Sergey Brin type. Pretty middle class. And I just thought it would be fun. I thought, like, well, if Bruce Sterling can say, you know, the poor love their cell phones to a crowd, I want to talk like that. I get one chance on earth. I just want to try it, you know? And if people say, oh, back down, you know, you're not allowed to talk this way, then, well, I tried.
Bruce and Barlow and I and a lot of other people were the founding people in the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conferences that go back to the 1990s, the early
Amazing,
1990s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I put together hackers and law enforcement folks and privacy folks.
Yep.
They were just terrific experience.
That is just so exciting because it's such, just to imagine you guys there, it's just with such a vocabulary apart from a way anybody else was talking. You know, it's just, unlike being part of like, you know, a small, you know, cadre of communists in the 30s, 40s, 50s or other small groups, the internet types, you know, like you and Barlow and so forth had their visions come to pass, And it's just been, you know, and I count myself in a small way in that group just because this digital culture that I saw in that first network computing era is exactly writ large what I see now, you know? And it's been just constantly inspiring and amazing and amusing and a little scary, but in an exciting way to be part of that and to see that.
Two of the great Barlow lines I'll share with you as an aside. He was on a special firing line one night that was hosted by Michael Kingsley and was a debate on what should be allowed on the internet. There was the people from who were concerned about their children and should there mm-hmm. be any censorship. And Bill Buckley was on that side and Barlow and Esther Dyson were on the other side. And the format was that each speak and there'd be one rebuttal. So Buckley speaks and then Barlow gets up and says, you know how daunting it is that I'm here and I'm faced with one of the world's great debaters. Do you know how difficult that is? It's the only thing, the only thing that I've going for me is I'm right.
Oh, I love it.
The other thing that he did, there was something at the, this is back in the mood days, and there was the panel at NYU Law School on moods, and Mike Godwin, who was the counselor for the EFF, was there, and Barlow and the bunch. And Barlow said, we have to learn to live in a world where the flesh becomes word.
Yes.
And that
I
was
love
just
that.
So good.
That is exactly the increasing abstraction. Increasing abstraction.
Yeah.
That is exactly. And, you know, and as a kind of libertarian, but a different kind of libertarian maybe than sometimes is meant by that word, you know, Barlow is exactly in that position to say, let language proliferate, let music proliferate, you know, that let that touch other people, let it be unbound, let it be free. And I am very, you know, sad to see people in journalism lose their jobs or in book publishing lose their jobs or see academia reconfigure itself. I mean, that's, I don't know what to say about that, except that everybody wants to keep their own jobs. You know, I've seen it all turn around and too. At the same time, we can't constantly make the case that whatever is necessary to keep our jobs is what's necessary for the culture. And, you know, just as many people who've had a hard time adapting to it, there have been a number of extraordinary, extraordinary voices that we never would have heard from without digital.
But we're also talking about now, going back to what they're calling a different thing, but it's a guaranteed annual wage. And people are saying, no, you can't do that. The socialism, well, in the United States, the first person to come up with it was Milton Friedman, who was a very conservative economist, and it was a favorite thing to Richard Nixon until people talked him out of it, saying, no, that'll never fly. So, and it's being tried in one city, in either Oregon or the state of Washington, under the grant from some companies. So I think at least some people that they're thinking about this, Robert Reich and two professors from MIT and me, who writes a column about it, but that's about it.
Interesting.
Diving back into the book, your approach to the internet as art, really as culture, seems quite unique to me. What prompted the book?
Well, you know, it might have been something. It really, I think the seed was planted with those early days on Conference XYZ. You know, I was doing computers, and I think my parents, I mean, thought that I must be doing something entirely in numbers. I mean, really, finally in numbers. But what I was doing was helping to invent a new massively multiplayer online role-playing game that is the internet. And so when it reappeared in the form of AOL and CompuServe with the early web, I just knew that's what we were doing again. You know, it was like, I guess I feel like Barlow. I just felt like, you know, wait, how is this different? How are writing these little bits of communications different from writing poetry or doggerel, you know, or bad poetry? It doesn't mean that it's good. It just meant that it was language with a lot of pressure on it, used often to try to seduce or, you know, convince, all the same ways that language and you know, rhetoric is supposed to behave, and on such a massive scale. I mean, you know, it was crazy because, like, at the same time you're trying to, like, teach students composition, they were starting, you know, in the later 90s and early part of this century to write blogs, you know, so just forcing them to write college essays, which just maybe wasn't their form, when they were thriving in these 500 word backward running blog posts, made me think, you know, there's something being done here. To renovate the language. And you always want to go where the language, I think, is most exciting. And the art is most exciting. You know, when Instagram appears, suddenly we decide Instagram is some kind of neurotoxin because there are a lot of self-portraits on it. And, you know, almost anyone could look at Instagram and say, oh, I see there's this rosy thing, or there's burnt, or it looks burnt out here, or the reason that it's supposed to look like a faded Polaroid here, you know, this is very different from how photography used to look on Flickr, and these are the reasons, or these are maybe the reasons. You know, while that's going on one level, somebody else is telling you why it means that we are, like, all a bunch of narcissistic assholes. Sorry, I hope I'm allowed to say that. But
there
those two things. Okay, that fake social science of the, like, we're all, you know, we're all going to hell, and our brains are being ruined by something to do with something I maybe saw in an fMRI once. And then the felt experience, the powerful sensory-emotional experience of, you know, of being online, of living online, of meeting people online, of forging new connections online, developing new capacities for compassion. I mean, you know, I feel like Twitch, for example, which I'm on a steep learning curve with, or Snapchat, which I, you know, I don't really know that well. And I don't mean to dwell on the social networks, but it's just that you have to get up to speed quickly on them. I mean, Twitch, I really feel like my brain is growing to see people do this thing, manage the split screen in these interesting ways. And you know, that's not an experience you expect to get all the time at 46, you know, that the world has all these new possibilities. And yet the internet's constantly giving them to us. So, you know, it was my lived experience of the internet that it was a cultural experience. I kept, you know, hearing that it was a business story. So reading books that were like, you know, called The One Thing You Need to Know About SEO or whatever, that, you know, it's about making money and making a new, you know, edamame cooking app or whatever. And then engineering stories that were really, you know, fascinating and well told. And then last, these like scared neuroscience stories about how bad it is for you. Or maybe they were just impressionistic stories about, oh, I used to, you know, have a lot more picnics, or, you know, my attention span was so long that I would just pick up The Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant in the morning and never look up except to have a sandwich at noon and read the whole thing until I went to bed. I mean, I kept hearing about how short our attention spans were, and I was wondering, how long did they used to be? What did that look like? You know, was there really a time where you read Kant in three sittings? And, you know, if so, is it such a bad thing we've lost that? You know, so I just felt like there was a lot of sophistry around the internet, and I hadn't seen my experience and the experience of, you know, I think now, you know, nearly, you know, I can almost say billions of us, or at least hundreds of millions of us who use the internet every day. I haven't seen it represented, and I wanted to take a shot at it.
You write about both the magic, the new that we experience, and the loss as we discard things that are of importance to us. Mm-hmm. Let's go through each of the sections of the book, then have you take just a few minutes to describe the magic and the loss. In the text portion, you quote Barlow saying that reading the internet was like drinking from the fire hose. Why don't you pick it up from there?
Well, you know, the reading on the web, at least on the you know, what I think of as the open web, is a really double-edged sword. For one, it's competitive and it's a game. So, you know, the way that Lenin saying who whom, you know, who's going to do it to whom. There's sort of a like read or be read thing on the internet where it's like if you you think you're reading, you know, even the Yahoo homepage, but in fact you're being read for data. You're having like your pocket picked at every turn, every time you click, every time you enter in, you know, are forced to turn over some information about yourself. And that data collection is what that, you know, that all those sand traps exist to get to do. So refusing to read, choosing not to read, is the signature act of the sort of the disciplined mind, I think, online. And that is that thought or that sort of realization grows straight out of hearing John Perry Barlow say that, yeah, reading on the internet is like drinking from a fire hose, which I heard him say at the Harvard Law School in 93, I think, which is that there's too much. There's just too much to read here, that as readers, we have to make the decision not to read. We have to make the choice not to read. And that choice, ideally, is inspired by knowing how to make our minds more beautiful, you know, and more humane places to live. And you know, we keep talking about, or it's a natural tendency to think that the culture is coarsening itself, that we're becoming less literate. One of the things I talk about in the book is something, you know, I think I and others have called hyperlexia, which is, you know, that we're reading excessively. And we're reading so excessively that we will risk highway fatalities now to keep consuming our chief intoxicant, which is literally text in the form of texting. Reading and writing. So making the decision to stay away from symbolic interactions is partly how you define yourself as a reader, and choosing, well, I'm going to read this in a book, or I'm going to read this, you know, I'm going to, you know, get this particular email in my inbox, and I'm not going to ever go to the homepage of Yahoo again, you know, or, you know, this thing seems mandatory to read because it's clickbait, but it is, but I am going to refuse to read it. Those are, I think, you know, the decisions that an educated mind makes. And in that way, you hydrate yourself from that fire hose without getting beheaded by the stream.
Okay. Then you have the short section on images. I was reminded in reading that by when I had a photographer, Sally Wynne McGrotto, on the show, and she talked about how that she got really interested in photography because her grandparents had only shoeboxes full of pictures that she looked at when she was very young. And she said, we don't have them anymore. And people, in many cases, have pictures on their phones. They have pictures up on the web. They have pictures in other places. They've got pictures on two different computers. And no one really takes the time to catalog them. And at some point, either the media could go away or the people could go away, and all the pictures go away.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the internet aims to spite us in some ways, but with its immortality, you know, it's almost this godlike. I mean, literally, the idea of the cloud, which was named in Houston by some people at Compaq, which is, you know, always been a sort of evangelical shop. The founder sat on the board of a very powerful evangelical church. So they name the cloud as this kind of heavenly spot where everything supposedly, all the souls last forever, the kingdom of heaven. But our photographs, may or may not last forever. But it's certainly, you know, become an article of faith that you just put it up there and that's, you know, it can absorb everything, right? And, you know, in the present moment, it's not a bad deal to make, which is like to sort of offload all this intellectual property to this space where it can like fit in with everything else that like best that's been done and thought and said in the world and the worst. You know, it stops us from having to feel like we're supposed to shore up our fragments as we live on Earth and, you know, surround ourselves with photo albums. I always felt that the pressure to, you know, make the photos tell a specific story and, you know, and frankly, the like pasting and getting little corners and making the books and all that stuff was just not my thing. But you know, I get if A, you enjoyed doing that and B, if you had a formative experience of coming to a box like that, you know, I think you might find that experience in other ways. I've been amazed to find scanned images of one of my grandfathers anyway, that appeared in obscure newspapers that have only recently been uploaded in PDF form and findable online. You know, it's these people who died before the appearance of the internet, but who live on the internet in a Wikipedia entry or whatever, in this living, breathing thing that interests me. And the idea that the photos change or that the text changes like Wikipedia does, I like that, you know, that it's not just captured in time in that box of photographs. On the other hand, I wouldn't want to take anything away from her with, you know, with that discovery. And there's a lot to, you know, mementos that seem like a hedge against death. You know, it's not surprising that she's looking at people who've died and wanting to hold on to that. You know, in some ways, I think, and this may get to, I don't know what, to stonery or something, but like the fact that there are, you know, I feel almost like, you know, the look like Plato and Aristotle, how Plato in the School of Athens, Raphael painting is pointing up to the sky and Aristotle's pointing down right here. You know, that the cloud, the Kurzweil vision of immortality purports that we're all data and photons and you know, creatures of light and symbols, and that we're, you know, that our bodies are what drag us down. And then, of course, there's the opposite argument that all of existence is right here in this present moment in our present bodies, with food, with the things that can't be digitized, with actual music, with the sound of vinyl, which we like because it is dying and decaying, because you can hear dust, because you can hear badly recorded bass, because you can hear grooves, because you can hear, you know, this sweet old world as it dies, as it's contained, you know, and that's where the meaning lies. And I think in that tension, you know, and you can imagine, or I can imagine, this woman coming on this box of photos that, you know, seem to keep her grandparents alive or give her some insight into their lives, you know, versus I can imagine another type seeing what's beautiful about that as the idea that in the cloud, you know, all their last communications or all their emails still live, or all of ours do. So I think that's a wonderful tension in the culture, and I think that's what culture has always been predicated on, that tension between love and death or life and death.
And then we have video. The whole television industry has been totally disrupted.
Mm. Yeah.
By Netflix and Amazon and Yahoo and everybody. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, YouTube, the book begins with... An experience I had with a video. I'd been reviewing television for the New York Times, and I came on a video just called Guitar of a kid playing Paco Bell's Canon, but a very difficult rock version of that song, that piece. And it just captivated me for 100 reasons. But I wanted to find out who he was, and I also wanted to find out why this video shot on a webcam with bright sunlight streaming in behind him, backlit, you know, in violation of every law of, you know, image and photography, and the sound, you know, just coming through my laptop speakers, why that image was so compelling. I just wanted to understand that, because I'd been reviewing huge big budget shows for HBO, and none of them had anything like the enthralling quality of this, and didn't attract the number of viewers this thing attracted. Which at the time was hard to understand. I think it was 2006. Now, you know, we get that there's something like in that particular short form, you know, 2 to 5 minute video, the sketch, the pop song, the, you know, passage of a piece of classical music, the how-to video, you know, the little dance video, the blooper, the fail video, you know, the rant, all these different forms that we've discovered on YouTube. I mean, nobody would have known that they existed, and yet there's something amazing about them. So the way that, yes, I mean, the first conferences I went to were in Hollywood. They were, you know, digital Hollywood. What are we going to do about the internet? Those conversations, you know, were less worrisome to me, except that I want everyone to have jobs. Less worrisome to me than it was exciting to me to see all this new material on YouTube and try to divine where it was coming from and you know what it might mean. I mean, it felt like I felt frankly like an archaeologist coming on a civilization and getting to be, you know, one of the first to look at some of these artifacts.
And finally, we have music where iTunes either saved or destroyed the industry, and now we have Spotify and Pandora, but none of the malls anymore have either photography shops or music stores. What's your take on the whole thing?
Yeah, music is, I mean, if video is what sort of triggered my sense of magic, set off my sense of magic, and that's where the book begins, music is the last chapter for a reason, which is that it was listening to my iPod right after September 11th, 2001. I was living in New York. We had living, you know, about a mile from the site where the towers had been. And the iPod was released, I think, in October, and I got one pretty soon after, and was just walking around dazedly listening to music all the time and trying to kind of shut out, I don't want to get too dramatic, but it was black helicopters and, you know, news reports all the time about what it meant and the war. And I just wanted to shut it out. So I would walk around wearing this thing and trying to figure out why the music sounded great and I was so glad to have control over it, and then why it sounded kind of weird. You know, that early MP3 compression, those early days, the music was missing a lot. You know, and that the same way that really dark space, that rich, fertile dark space that I saw on the computer screen that I described, you know, that was so inspiring. This was almost, there was something kind of like deadening. You know that thing that Garry Kasparov said when he lost to Deep Blue, like, I've lost the will to play?
Yeah.
You know, he said that. I felt like overmatched in some way by that. You know, I thought, oh, well, now there's an infinite number of songs in my pocket. And guess what? I've lost the will to listen. And I wanted to put my finger on that feeling of defeat that plenty of people get in the face of Google, in the face of the internet, in the face of the idea, there's too much here. I can't do this. I can't keep up with this. Too many people, too many artifacts, too many, you know, tweets. And I had that with music, and that, you know, really heavy feeling of grieving that clearly was tied up with the, you know, with 9/11. But that's the lost part of the book. And, you know, as much as I sound like a Bolshevik for the internet, there's a lot of loss and sort of insults to our personal and collective organization that the internet has visited on us. You know, fortunately, art contains an element of loss to it. I mean, there's nothing in this book that says the internet is, you know, a benevolent force for mankind, or that it's the, you know, best thing that ever happened to us, or that it makes us healthier or more moral or more principled or ethical. I do think some of those things, but the argument that it's art is the argument that it contains both agony and ecstasy.
Good line. And then this terrific book concludes with a section, even if you don't believe in it, which takes the reader through your personal intellectual growth and your religious search, but even the mention of your family. We've discussed this portion of the book earlier. Is there anything you'd like to add about this section?
I don't think I've ever talked about it so openly as I did with you. And I, you know, it's funny because that chapter, that was the chapter I was most hesitant to write. It's, you know, it's hard to write about your education. And, I sort of thought it's okay. Somehow it's okay to write, like, for a woman to write, like, a sexual coming of age or an addiction memoir or all kinds of things. But somehow, at least to me, it felt like a little bit brazen, or, like, you know, it took some chutzpah to write my intellectual coming of age. But because I love to read them, I thought I'd try my hand at one. And I also, you know, I grew up in sync with the internet, so I really wanted to be able, it was a very personal story. But it's also, it really is an invitation for readers, and I've been amazed on this book tour to have conversations with millennials, with, you know, pensioners, with all ages, former veterans who worked with radar and sonar and then discovered themselves on the internet. You know, what is our, and certainly with Luddites or dark internet types who stay off, you know, the commercial part of the internet altogether and don't want anything to do with it. And then venture capitalists who, you know, are, you know, just trying to find themselves morally and emotionally in a world of, like, you know, a great amount of inflation and maybe a real venture bubble, but then all these fortunes to be made. You know, all those people have amazing stories to tell. And so that last chapter, you know, is a way, an invitation for everyone to look closely at their lives online, you know, and try to tune into the magic and the loss of those experiences.
Once again, I hope that listeners come away with an appreciation of the depth of magic and loss, while taking my word that it is not a difficult book. In short, I again recommend this purchase. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm playing around with, I'm still covering the convention for the Times, and I'm playing around though with the next book is about anti-digital culture. So about the way the material world really kind of fights back and pushes back. And we've seen, you know, we've really seen some beautiful new phenomena, including maker culture, as I said, foodism, the rise of live music, you know, just that return of bodies in space. I'll close with one thing. There was a kid in Silicon Valley recently who discovered he was addicted to Facebook, decided he wanted to get off it, and he did it this way. He did it the Northern California way. I don't recommend it to your listeners, but he decided to take a tiny bit of LSD, a microdose, under his skin in the morning. Well, what he found was he completely lost interest in the dreadfully boring interface of his iPhone because the faces of people on the bus looked so beautiful. And that is exactly the kind of pushback that I'm interested in the next book.
When is the paperback of this book due out?
We haven't set a date for it yet. It's doing fairly well in hardback. I'm grateful for any, you know, reviews, and obviously anyone who wants to pick it up and read it and tell me what they think. I'm very findable on the internet.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Virginia Heffner?
Just how grateful I am that you have me on the show and that you persevered, because we've been talking for a while about this, and I'm glad we did it.
Thank you, Virginia. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, John.
A bit of commercial information. My column now appears biweekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. We'll be back again by next week with Inward Eye, the next 60 Minutes producer, Dennis Blakely. And I hope you'll join us then. Until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Keep moving, Tantra. Thank you again, Virginia.
Thank you very much. See you on the internet.
And good night, all.